And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Mars. See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain. Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast, from classics to cults and all the cheese in between. The movies might be B, but the entertainment is grade A. My name is Luke Giaconetti, and I am your host, and today we're going to be taking a look at a very unusual Italian horror film, Caltiki, the Immortal Monster, from 1959, and we will get to that right after this.
Ages ago, in a long-lost part of the world, the Mayans worshipped a terrifying goddess. To her, men offered their strength and their devotion. Women offered the beauty of their bodies. Caltiki, the immortal monster. Today, courageous adventurers, dedicated scientists of both sexes, begin the exploration of recently discovered caverns buried in the very womb of the Earth. From space beyond space comes force beyond measurement, energizing this monstrous mass of man-eating protoplasm that devours every living thing it touches.
When her mate appears in the sky, the power of Caltiki will destroy the world. You can believe what you like. Caltiki's been reborn.
All civilians are to remain in their homes until further orders. Every precaution has been taken to combat the danger the city faces, and all citizens are urged to remain calm. That is all for now.
Can anything on this earth stop Caltiki, the immortal monster?
Caltiki, the Immortal Monster, was produced in 1959 in its native Italian as Caltiki, il Mostro Immortale, with a runtime of 76 minutes. It was produced by the Italian outfit Galatea Film, with some involvement from the French company Climax Pictures, and distributed by Lux Film. It was released in Italy on August 8th, 1959, and made it over to the United States in September of 1960 with a dub by Titras Studios, who did a lot of dubbing for films imported into the United States of this era, including many of the early Toho Daikaiju films. Our director is Riccardo Freda, who you may know from as a director of I, Vampiri, and many other genre films, including Sins of Rome, Giants of Thessaly, and Samson and the Seven Miracles of the World. Now, this is a bit of a bone of contention because the film was also at least partially directed by Mario Bava, generally regarded as the grandfather of Italian horror, directing such films as Black Sunday, The Girl Who Saw Too Much, Kill Baby Kill, Twitch of the Death Nerve, Whip in the Body, Blood and Black Lace, Danger Diabolic, and many other films. We'll get to that after we go through the synopsis. Our writer was Filippo Sangist and Riccardo Freda, and our producer was Nello Santi. And our story goes a little something like this. At a Mayan excavation site, a delirious archaeologist named Nato stumbles into his group's camp without his partner, both of whom have been exploring a nearby cave, ranting about a volcano and Kaltiki. He quickly goes mad, requiring hospitalization. The rest of the party, John Fielding, Max Gunther, and Bob, who cannot afford a last name, are intrigued by his rantings and the film which they find in his handheld camera, which seems to show the two being attacked by something which came out of a cave pond. Leaving Naito in the care of Ellen and Linda, John's wife and Max's girlfriend, respectively, the group sets out for the cave. Once there, they find a deep pool of water, behind which is a large statue of Kaltiki, the vengeful Mayan goddess who was ceremoniously presented with human sacrifices. Hoping to find evidence of the dead man, along with maybe some artifacts, Bob dons underwater gear and dives down into the pool. At the bottom, he finds a menagerie of skeletons clad in gold jewelry. Running out of oxygen, Bob comes back up, clutching as much gold as he can carry. Although John and Max don't want him to return down, Bob insists on doing so, suggesting that the three could become very wealthy from the treasures below. Relenting, the other two let Bob descend once more. As he collects more and more treasure, the lifeline suddenly begins to move erratically. Fearing for Bob's safety, John and Max pull him back to the surface, only to find, upon removing his face mask, that his flesh has been reduced to a decaying mass over his skeleton. Moments later, the shapeless creature that attacked him rears up from the pool, attempting to digest anyone within reach. Max is caught by the arm, but then is rescued by John, who hacks off a piece of the blob to separate Max from it. As the group escapes, the shapeless mass begins to crawl out of the cave. John dashes to a nearby gasoline truck, then crashes the truck directly into the moving mass, which violently explodes and sets fire to the blob, destroying it. The team returns to Mexico City to take Max to a hospital. Still on his arm is a small piece of the blob, which is slowly digesting him. Ugh. The surgeons carefully remove the creature and find that Max's arm is nothing more than a few moist scrapes of flesh still connected to the underlying bone. The small piece of the creature is taken by John to his house for further study in hope of finding a cure to the toxins which it has left in Max's body. After further experimenting on the creature, John and his colleague Professor Rodriguez discover that it is a unicellular bacterium that quickly grows when in the presence of radiation, and that the creature is essentially immortal, being dated back at least 20 million years. For his part, Max has become unpredictable and moody during his hospital stay until he finally snaps. He beats a nurse to death and escapes, making a beeline for John and Ellen's house, as he had been lusting after Ellen during the Mayan expedition. Instead, he finds his girl Linda, who hides him in the Fielding's basement, protecting him for, misguided reasons. John's research turns up a bit of Mayan legend that the immortal god, Kaltiki, had a mate which would come from the sky. Amazingly, or maybe not so amazingly, a comet emitting radiation that crosses Earth's path only once in every 850 years is quickly approaching. At the comet's closest approach to Earth, the remaining piece of the blob, stored in a Tupperware container at John's house, begins expanding to an enormous size very rapidly. While attempting to convince the Mexican government to send its army to destroy the reproducing blobs, John is arrested, but manages to escape. Back at home, Max has really lost it and kills Linda while stalking Ellen and the Fielding's young daughter, Janie. Professor Rodriguez finally convinces the authorities to sound an alarm because the multiplying creatures will soon be even beyond their ability to control. The government marshals a regiment of soldiers equipped with flamethrowers and sends them to John's house. Upon their arrival, they find that the amorphous blobs have continued to multiply and have overrun the house and grounds. Inside, Kaltiki continues to grow without stopping, crushing its way through doors and walls, forcing Ellen and Janie to escape to a second-story balcony. John dodges among the various blobs of Kaltiki to grab a ladder and rescue them, but Kaltiki eats the bottom of the ladder, causing them to fall, albeit safely, away from the blobs. As the Fieldings retreat, the Mexican Army's armored infantry finally shows up as tanks pour onto the scene, immolating Kaltiki with fire and destroying it forever. So that's our story of Kaltiki the Immortal Monster. Very unusual film for an Italian film here. We'll get into some of the production here. Let's go right into the notes. So I said earlier that there is some distinction to be made in this film, whether it directed by Freda or Bava, and how much of it was directed by each. Now, the story goes that Ricardo Freda wanted to give Mario Bava a chance to direct because they had worked together on I, Vampiri, and Bava had done cinematography for some of Freda's earlier films. So supposedly Freda left the film knowing that Bava would have to step in and be the director. Now, how much of the film is Freda and how much is Bava is the source of contention here. Some accounts say that Freda left with only about 2 days left of shooting, but that he had tried to make the film in Bava's style so that when Bava took over, it would still be fit in with his work. Other accounts say that Freda left very early on and that Bava ended up doing the lion's share of the work. And yet another account says that Bava primarily directed the special effects sequences in addition to his cinematography responsibility. So this would be the shots of Kaltiki, the shots of the model tanks, and the soldiers with the flamethrowers. Now, how exactly this broke down will never be known for sure at this point. The players involved are all deceased, and frankly, it's kind of been lost to history. It's an interesting pedigree to have, Freda, a very, well-known and prolific Italian genre filmmaker who made film. He made Peplum, he made Giallo, he made horror films, he made all sorts of different things. And then Bava, of course, best known for his horror stuff, but also had his hand in Peplum and some other genres as well, touching this movie that ostensibly is just a Monster on the Loose movie. We don't necessarily think of Kaltiki as a seminal part of Italian horror, but it followed on very closely after I, Vampiri, which is generally considered the first modern, air quotes up to the microphone, Italian horror film. And one interesting thing we see very early on in this film, and actually throughout most of the entire film, is the use of light and dark, which is harsh lighting and then heavy shadows. We see this right from the start at the expedition, as a lot of the expedition is seemingly lit by torchlight or firelight. And so we get sharp uses of black and people stepping in and out of the shadows and all that, which is, to me, is always something I associate with Bava. He did this a lot on a lot of his horror work, but he did this also even in some of his color films with the use of light and shadow. So it's very striking to see a cheap 50s monster movie have such a creative use of light and darkness, which I really liked. Those early scenes are supposed to be taking place at a Maya ruin, and they look really good. It looks like a location, even though it's not. I'm sure it's something on the Italian countryside that's been dressed up to look like a Maya ruins, but it's actually quite believable. Many years ago, my wife and I went to Belize, and we got to visit some Mayan ruins, and these look really close. I'm willing, especially in black and white, I'm very willing to accept it. So I think that's a really good use of available locations to tell the plot setting that we need for this film. As an aside, we've got a bunch of white archaeologists in caves. My first instinct is this a mummy movie? White archaeologists in caves, that suggests that there's going to be some kind of a curse and a bandage guy shambling around, but of course that doesn't happen. After Niaito gets back, the party reviews the handheld camera footage. They project out the film and try and get an idea of what happened to their scouting party. And I really like this. The handheld camera footage, it looks like it was actually shot on a handheld. So this is a very creative use of it. You know, a lot of times, it's supposed to be a handheld and it's clearly shot with a camera that's, being steadied, or it's tripod mounted or whatever. This looks like the guy's actually holding it. So that was a good attention to detail there. I'm not sure, again, who would be credited for directing that, but as a cinematographer, that would probably fall to Bava to plan the shot with the handheld like that. So I think that's a really, really nice little touch. While at the camp, we get a kind of musical interlude of sorts with the Indians, the native Indians who are doing the, you know, they're the porters and the diggers. They have a song and dance routine. This kind of reminds me of what you'd see in a peplum, when there'd be a song and dance routine kind of in the middle where the girl's kind of showing off and all that. It serves to show that Max is a lecherous SOB. And that's kind of the main point. Gives him the native girl to leer at, and also breaks up the early parts of the story a little bit. Now, once they get to the cave, they go into this pond, right? And this is a super deep pond, because they, you know, when Bob goes down, you can't see the top. That's how far deep he is in this pond, clearly shooting in an effects pool. Now, the underwater shooting is actually quite nice. It's nothing any, you know, there's no great, there's not a lot of action or anything. It's mostly Bob walking around, but it's a very stark, flat back bottom on this pond. It's almost like it's a man-made pond, almost as if it was like a effects tank, like I said. But again, it's pretty ambitious to have the underwater shooting like that in a low-budget film here in the late 50s here in Italy. So that was a nice touch. I mean, they very easily could have done this. They could have faked this, you know, faked underwater, but there's actual underwater shooting. So again, good on Freda and Bava for, you know, going the extra mile in their shot list like that. I do have to say, when they go to the lake, they bring a Geiger counter, and it starts clicking off. So they know there's radiation. And then Bob's going to go swim in it. I don't know that you could pay me enough to swim in a radioactive lake. Sure, you're going to bring up all these golden artifacts and all that. How are you going to spend it if you're dead? All it's going to be doing is paying for your hospital bed as you slowly die from radiation poisoning. So I don't know about that. That, you know, hey, it was the 50s. Radiation did all sorts of things. But apparently what it didn't do was kill you. So I guess that's okay. Now, when they pull Bob up and they rip his mask off, this is the first of a couple of really kind of really striking effects here. They pull the mask off and the flesh is just eaten off his face, and there's just scraps and stuff and on his face. And it's like, yikes on a stick. That is really gruesome for 1959. Now, being in black and white helps. I imagine if this was in color, it would look substantially more gruesome, but it might also have, you know, because now you've got to match blood color and all that, so it might look a little bit more silly. But in black and white, this is such a stark image, and it's happened so quick. They pull the mask off. There's no build-up or anything to it. You just pull the mask up, and then there it is. So that was a really cool shot. I really like that. And it shows that Kaltiki is a... that this monster is not messing around. Now, we haven't seen Kaltiki yet. The reveal of Kaltiki comes right after this. About 20 minutes into the film, Kaltiki, she's a big formless blob, and she appears, she's really a man in a suit, basically. Yeah, now there's where you see it just kind of writhing around and slugging around. It's kind of, it's not perfectly smooth on the outside. It's got some texture and definition, but it mostly looks just like a big writhing mess, which makes sense. Big formless blob. Now, as big formless blobs go, this is kind of an interesting way to do it. You know, it's hard to top the blob as far as big formless blobs, but the blob had the advantage of being in color, and this is in black and white. So Kaltiki doesn't look quite as impressive as the blob, but for a black and white film, I think she is represented quite nicely, and the immediate effects of her touch means that Kaltiki, she gets put over as a real menace, even if the effect is not the most sophisticated one. You know, speaking of which, Max immediately goes for the gold because, you know, we've already established Max is a lecherous guy, so obviously he's got to be a poor moral character in general. And so he goes for the gold, gets caught. And we just saw what Kaltiki did to Bob through the dive suit, and now it's got, Max by the arm, and it's like, well, that's not good. He's in trouble. And it's only the quick thinking of John that comes and he cuts the piece off, and that's it. But they can't get it off, and they're still obviously afraid of getting eaten, so they just go. Again, obviously, this is a crucial aspect to get a piece of Kaltiki, a good way to do it, because also now it introduces that we've already seen what the effects of having Kaltiki touch human flesh does, and now we're putting it on somebody else and bringing it along. So we've already, they've done a good job of establishing what the consequence of this action is, and now they're showing us the action again. So I thought that was nice. So as the group escapes from the cave and John goes to get the gasoline truck, we get the first instance of the miniature effects shooting. And it's a nice match between the miniature and the full size truck that John interacts with. It looks like it wouldn't be too out of place from a more experienced miniatures unit like a Toho. But this is more akin to something we got in like Gojira or Godzilla Raids Again than it is for some of the films that they were doing by the early 60s as far as the level of detail. It's a nice enough miniature, and again, in black and white, that kind of helps cover some of the rough edges, and it looks nice. Plus, it's a really big explosion, and everybody loves a big explosion in the first half hour of your movie, right? So I'm down with that. Back in Mexico City, they remove Kaltiki from Max's arm, and once again, yikes! Just yikes! I mean, there's these little scraps of flesh and stuff on it. It is gross. This is a nasty, gruesome effect for ostensibly just, a cheap blob movie from Italy from 1959. But this is really nice. It took me by surprise the first time I saw this because it's like, damn, that's not fooling around. That's pretty nasty. So again, those effects of Kaltiki eating people are really well done and to me help the film stand out over, some of its other cheapy blob. I don't know, are there other cheapy blob ripoffs besides Son of Blob, which itself is kind of a, ripoff of itself? I like this. Reminds me of kind of some of the stuff we'd get in, like the remake of The Blob. They were a bit more gruesome with it. And this, I like that, seeing that, 30 years beforehand. I like that very much. The research comes out that the Kaltiki is a unicellular organism. I like this. Although it does beg the question, if it's a unicellular organism, how is it growing? Because normally you'd think that, okay, it splits and reproduces. I get that. Each one is a single cell. I'm okay with that. How does it grow? That's what I want to know. I mean, does the cell itself keep growing? Because it would make more sense if it was a multicellular organism and it got bigger and bigger and bigger just because it kept dividing and, cellular mitosis. But how does a single cell keep growing and then split off into new ones? Maybe it has to grow a certain size and then it splits because there's a bunch of them by the end of it. Maybe each one grows independent and as bits are broken off, they can reproduce. I don't know. It's not really explained and I don't expect an explanation in a 76 minutes runtime. I don't need an explanation. It's just kind of food for thought. It's one of those monster questions that you find yourself asking after you've watched the film and you settle down to do your notes. The other bit of this I liked is that the scientists are able to use radioactive dating to date Kaltiki to being 20 million years old. I like that kind of stuff, that this is this ancient thing that's ravaged the world for all this time and has happened to be dormant. And there's a whole bit about the reason why they're at the Mayan site is to determine why this Mayan site was simply abandoned by the Mayans for no discernible reason that they can find in the archaeological evidence. And that ties in with the coming of the comet. And that the comet came and Kaltiki grew giant, so the Aztecs simply abandoned it and ran away from Kaltiki. So I do like that. I like ancient things like that, so I thought that was pretty cool, a little touch that they didn't have to put in. But it does also tie in that Kaltiki is, in fact, the immortal monster. So I thought that was, it's not just a catchphrase, it actually is part of the story. So that's good marketing right there. John brings Kaltiki to his house and stores her in Tupperware. This is what you do, of course. Now the problem comes in that he actually stores her in the Tupperware, but he doesn't burp the Tupperware, clearly. So if you want to get that good airtight seal, you got to burp it out. Otherwise, she wouldn't have escaped when the comet came up. I don't know. I mean, although it does beg the question, if it can eat through human flesh, what's keeping it from eating through this container that John has got her stored in? But again, these are the questions that we are not supposed to ask. Now, things take kind of a weird turn when Max finally loses his and goes crazy at the hospital. He beats the nurse to death, and it's off camera at least, but man, he is just savagely just beating on this poor woman. And it's, again, you have a hard time buying that this would have been in a 1959 film made in the United States. Being made a European film, I think I'm a bit more understanding of where that came from, but I imagine this was probably pretty shocking. I mean, it's one thing to have a monster, menace a girl, but to have a nurse get beaten to death by a guy, even if he is going crazy, is a, That's a little much for 1959. Again, they play with the light and the shadow here as harsh lighting all throughout the hospital as Max's mental state is called into question quite a lot here. Obviously, he's off his rocker at this point. But again, it looks really nice with the light and the shadow. At one point during the mad scramble with John trying to get the authorities' attention, there is a car crash for no reason. Always a sign of a good Bots, Bugs, and Babes movie when we have a car crash and explosion for no reason, so good on that. Now, back at the house, Kaltiki begins to grow giant, escapes from a Tupperware, begins expanding and reproducing. Kaltiki is pretty gross as blobs go. The Suitmation does give it this kind of weird internal writhing as I'm doing it up to the microphone for y'all to see. And it really does look very effective, even if it's very simply probably just painted burlap and such to make the monster. But in black and white, you can get away with some of that. And it really does move real nicely and very kind of in, or you know, in a non-humanoid way, despite ostensibly being, you know, Suitmation. It really does move like a big blob. So I think that's well realized here. Building upon having the nurse being beaten to death a few minutes earlier, another woman is killed as Linda gets in Max's way and he has finally had enough of her Latin charms and kills her while trying to go get Ellen, who's the one he really wants, because obviously she's the white woman. There are some things that transcend borders in the 1950s, and that's one of them, I guess. So two women, brutally killed in the course of this film. Just not something I would have expected in a film from 1959, European or otherwise. So that really stood out to me upon this viewing. Now, Kaltiki, we get some more miniature effects with Kaltiki here, where we've got a miniature, like, Doll's House size version of the interior of the house with giant Kaltiki kind of being, I'm guessing it's a polymer or plastic of some kind, and it's being pushed with compressed air, is the way it looks like it's done. And Kaltiki is crashing through walls, climbing up stairwells, I mean, just expanding and expanding. And there's a great bit here where Max has Linda and Janie kind of cornered, and Kaltiki crashes through the wall, just bursts through the wall, and immediately just kind of rolls over and eats Max. And at this point, Kaltiki has gotten so large that apparently the toxins that she secretes are so strong, and the acids, I would guess, whatever caustic agents her skin must produce, all that's left is a skull. We see the flesh basically being yanked off of his face and just a skull peering out. It's really very gruesome. And again, one wonders how this would have looked in color. But in black and white, it really is effective, and it's very, very well done. Kind of a, stylistic version of a gore effect for a black and white film from 1959. I really liked that. It's kind of the capper of the three really gruesome effects in the film. And to me, it's the best one, and it is the most dramatic. So very, very cool scene here. John has gotten himself arrested because he's ranting like a madman about monsters at his house and trying to go and get him. So he gets arrested. And so he does the classic B-movie technique of the old fake-out. He makes a big noise in his cell, hides behind the door, and then clobbers the guard in the head and runs out. The old fake-out works every single time. You'd think that any of these guards in any of these movies might have seen another B-movie and known to send two guys and have one stand outside and one go in. Nope, every time, one guy. This is what happens when you cut the budgets for guys that, you know, are the guards where heroes of films are unjustly imprisoned during the third act. This is the price you pay, is to have the old fake out done on you. Back at the John's house, Kaltiki is now gigantic. It's really gotten huge. It's taking up most of any shot that she is in with humans. She takes up almost the entire frame. And Ellen and Janie are in a lot of peril here. They're running basically from room to room, and Kaltiki keeps, you know, oozing through doorways and chasing after them. It's, you know, one of these things about having a completely inhuman monster that you're not tempted to assign it any human intelligence. We talk about this sometimes with films involving monsters that are reptilian or insectoid, but the same works here. Kaltiki is such a relatively low-level life form, being a bacteria, essentially, that there's no risk of the audience anthropomorphizing the monster and assigning it human-style motivations and desires. Here, it's growing and seeking out food because that's what it does. That's the level of on the hierarchy of life that it operates at. And I really like that. It's very much just a thing that's going to keep expanding, keep seeking out new sources of food. If left to its own devices, it's not actively menacing her. It's just trying to eat her because she is food. And so I really liked that. And the family in peril aspect is done really nice because there doesn't seem to be a way out. They're trapped on the second story and then they go out on the balcony even, and they got the young girl, and the mom. So I thought that was really nice. John making the rescue with the ladder, it seems like, oh, okay, they're just going to climb down. But even that gets subverted because they start eating the ladder. And it just so happens that the ladder is tall enough that when they fall kind of in the middle of them, away from any particular Kaltiki blob, and then they're able to pull back and let the army take over. Speaking of which, I love the models of all the tanks here that is rolling up. Again, looks like something we probably would have seen about 5 years earlier out of a Japanese film, but looks good, especially for they're hidden enough in the shadow that they look pretty decent. I mean, you never think that they're real tanks and not models. But it's good enough that you're willing to accept it for the purposes of a film, you know? Now, these are apparently flame tanks. Somebody call Games Workshop because we got some flamers on these tanks here because they don't fire shells. They only fire flamethrowers. And I didn't know that there were that many tanks equipped with flamethrowers as their primary weapon. I can understand, again, being the 50s, the guys carrying handheld flamethrowers, but tanks using flamethrowers as their modern main weapon in the modern era is not really a thing by the late 50s. I mean, they usually would have at least some other type of main gun, and then they might have a flamethrower port, or they might have a mounted flamer of some kind, but you know what? Who cares? I mean, this is cool. We get all these tanks belching out all these flames and burning Kaltiki back, and the day is saved in a big fiery inferno. So that, if you're going to go out, going out in a fiery inferno is a pretty good way to go. So that was a satisfying ending, which is really all I'm looking for in a monster movie. We've had our monster on the loose. We've had some really, you know, kind of nasty after effect shots of Kaltiki eating people. Now it's time for the big finish, and what better way to big finish than kill it with fire? Overall, not a bad little monster movie, frankly, despite quite a lot of talky bits in the middle, but that's kind of endemic of the way genre films were made in the 50s, both here in the States and abroad. You gotta have some talky bits in the middle. Talky bits are relatively cheap, so it is helped out tremendously by the use of very effective, moody black and white and the lighting. Like I said, the harsh lighting going with the moody black and white shooting really helps this film look like something from a different, more expensive movie than this film's kind of B origins. Kaltiki herself being a blob, not the most creative of monsters, but as I said, she is well realized, especially the scale stuff in the final reel, which to me, I really liked because in addition to the craftsmanship of doing the scale stuff, it adds a level of claustrophobia to the kind of standard blob action. You know, blob films, a lot of times, yes, you'll have someone, in a tight enclosed space. And I think Kaltiki does a good job of showing how this house, that ostensibly this large house, suddenly becomes very, very small when all of it is slowly being cut off and there's no way out. And now you're trapped inside or trapped on top. And the, you know, Kaltiki herself is just nonstop and relentless because she's got so much energy bulging in her from the radiation that she just keeps coming and coming. So I thought that was really nice. And I said that claustrophobia is a commonly used aspect in a lot of different horror genres, but especially monster genres, that idea of being in a tight space that you can't escape. I really liked that. And I thought that was a good use of both the direction and the cinematography to show the house kind of this claustrophobic style space with Kaltiki closing in. So I thought that was really nice. The performances themselves, nothing special. Our cast here is primarily folks you'll see in other Italian genre films. So, you know, not anyone you might particularly recognize. It's not helped really by the dub either way. Tetris did decent dubs, not great. But to me, they're better than you know, some of what we would call the international dubs done in Hong Kong and stuff like that for a lot of Japanese films. It's fine. It's totally serviceable. It's understandable. But what I think does help the film is that it's earnest when necessary, And so, like, when scenes when John and the professor are talking to, they're having like a press conference and are, you know, very earnestly explaining everything that's going on. Everything is taken quite seriously for, you know, a monster movie. And that helps. And there's a distinct lack of comedy, as we might have found in an American film from the same era. There's no comic relief characters. There's no, like, you know, drunk guy doing a double take and throwing his bottle away or anything like that. It's played very straight. And I think that helps. You know, it helps keep our disbelief going that we're, you know, the filmmakers aren't pointing out the potential humor of the situation of the film, not so much of the plot, but of the production of the film by having a comic relief character. Here they just play it straight. And I think that really does kind of, you know, enhance the overall viewing. It's worth checking out, I think, if nothing else, as one of the more unusual Italian horror movies. As when I think of Italian horror, the two main things I think of are Gothic Spookfest, which this certainly is not. I mean, it's moody, but it's not gothic. Or a bloody splatter film, and it's certainly not that, even though, as I said, it has some gore aspects to it. So it kind of exists at a weird point where we've had, you know, the Italian genre films have really started to come on here into the 50s, but we're not at, like, Bava's heyday, or even, obviously, the guys that come after Bava, as far as the use of gore and violence. But we do have some of those elements being shown. We have, you know, gore effects. We have the moodiness of the Gothic films. We have the harsh use of light and shadow, not in color, but in black and white. But it's the same idea of using the palette available as a filmmaker to create a mood, an evocative mood based just on the light and darkness. We have the level of violence. We have two women being brutally killed by not a monster, but a man. Admittedly, a man driven crazy because of the monster, but still a man. So that those are kind of these generic elements that we would see play up later on in the Italian horror films, kind of getting a little bit of a play here in what is ostensibly just a monster on the loose romp. So I think Caltiki is worth checking out. And if you want to check out Caltiki, you can own it on a 2-disc Blu-ray and DVD set from Arrow Video. Now, this is a new 2K restoration. It's just looking down the laundry list of bonus features on this and commentaries. There's a lot of stuff to unpack on this set. It has both the Italian and the English language tracks, which is a nice touch, and brand new translated English subtitles, which is also very nice. I've never seen this film in Italian, only in the American versions, what I'm trying to say, in English. So that alone is pretty cool. It makes me want to check out that 2-disc set right there. That is going right now for $17.42 on Amazon as I record this. You can also view the film on Amazon Video. You can standard def or high def, rent or own, and you can find the film dubbed on archive.org if you just want to check it out before you pick it up. And of course, if you're going to buy anything that is discussed here on Bots, Bugs, and Babes, please go to twotruefreaks.com, click on that amazon.com link before you make your purchases, and that gives a little bit kickback here to keep the lights on here at Two True Freaks. So what did you guys think? Have you seen Caltiki the Immortal Monster? Why don't you send your feedback to botsbugsbabes@gmail.com, and of course all the ways you can get in touch with the show will be in the outro as well. I really enjoyed this one, and I'm eager to hear what you listeners thought of this one if you have a chance to check it out. So I think I've just about covered Caltiki, so keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?